Good afternoon. Members, I call this meeting on Human Service Finance Committee to order. With that, members, would like to start with the approval of the minutes for February 2nd, 2023. Lead New Brindley, will you like to move the approval for the minutes?
I haven't seen them yet, but sure, let's do it.
If you haven't done so, we can ask the other members who have already gone through. I'll give you the time.
Yes, Chair Noor, I'd love to move the minutes for February 2nd.
Lee New Burnley moved the approval for minutes for February 2nd, 2023. Discussions? See none. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? See none. The motion, the minutes for February 2nd, 2023 are now approved. Members, I would like to note that we do have a quorum present, so we can start with our work. And today, we have a discussion that will be talking about the unwinding of the continuous eligibility. To begin with, I think this is an important discussion, members. From March 2020 until April 1, 2023, Minnesotans, along with other states, were required to maintain continuous eligibility for those who are enrolled in medical assistance. The continuous enrollment significantly reduces the number of individuals ineligible for medical assistance due to the change of circumstances, such as income changes and other issues, which is quite frankly known as Medicaid CHAN, which we will be talking about in other discussions. On December 29, 2022, President Biden signed the Consolidated Appropriation Act of 2023 that ends the eligibility requirement for continuous eligibility as of March 31, 2023. If you look back, members, the Families First Coronavirus Response Act provided additional funds through the enhanced FMAP, which provided us with 6.2%, which will now go on until the end of the calendar year to 5%, to 2.5%, and 1.5%. Quite frankly, we need to reinvest these resources back into supporting individuals so that we can help them continue with their eligibility. Unfortunately, through this process, thousands of Minnesotans will lose their eligibility. The fact that we know that many are going to lose, we need to stay ahead of the curve, meaning that we have to start investing in communication, in our systems, in navigators, making sure that no one who's eligible is excluded from the Medicaid eligibility. I know we can do this because this does not have to wait until we, until the end of session. We can do it now and support the department to be ready. As we hear the plan today, I hope members will be able to support, all of us should be able to support the department to achieve the goal of making sure that no Minnesotan who is eligible for Medicaid loses the eligibility because we didn't do our job. So with that, I would like to welcome Assistant Commissioner of State Medicaid Director, Director McDowell, and also Director Health Gibson, who is the Director for Healthcare Eligibility and Access and Healthcare Administration. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much, Chairman Noor, and thank you, members of the committee, for having us here. As Chairman Noor indicated, I am Cynthia McDonald. I am the Assistant Commissioner of Healthcare for DHS. And I suppose I should check to make sure you can hear me. I have a quieter voice sometimes in these rooms, but also the state Medicaid director. And it's my great pleasure to hold these jobs and to talk with you today about the critical large body of work that the department is working on, among many other things, but this is very much a premier piece of work. And I will turn it over just so my colleague Karen Gibson can introduce herself, and I'll just note that Karen Gibson is here. She's the director of our eligibility policy and program area, and has over 40 years of experience in eligibility. And in fact, that's very common within the Department of Human Services to have very experienced people working in this particular area around eligibility. So Karen, I'll just give you a minute.
Chair, committee members, good afternoon. My name is Karen Gibson. I'm the Director of Healthcare Eligibility and Access in the Healthcare Administration at the Department of Human Services. I did start at a very young age with the 40 years, so just FYI. And nothing, I don't think, has prepared any state for what we're about to face. So thank you for having us this afternoon.
Very good. But let me take you through the journey of talking about this, and again, we're very happy to do that. We'll talk a bit about the fact that DHS has been preparing for the resumption of the renewal process, the eligibility renewal process for our state public programs for many months. Actually, I can now attach years to it, at least a couple of years. And it's important to note that eligibility and the renewal process is a regular process for DHS, for each of the counties, and a tribe that also does processing at this time, White Earth. And it is a regular part of our process, and so in that sense, it's what we know how to do, and we do it well. The difference here is the volume and the fact that all 1.5 million people in the state of Minnesota who are on Medicaid, or it's called medical assistance here, and on Minnesota Care, all have to be renewed under the coverage, and we'll go into that. And then in addition, we'll talk certainly through some challenge pieces, so we have a real conversation about that, and then also talk about, especially about our plan and our path forward. And we boomers will try to work the technology system, so we'll see if we can keep track of ourselves here. All right. So like all states across the country, every state, Minnesota has maintained health care coverage for Medicaid enrollees during the pandemic. And since March of 2020, Minnesotans who newly gained eligibility or already had eligibility for Medicaid or Minnesota Care have remained enrolled regardless of the changes that they otherwise would have been perhaps disenrolled for along this time. So continuous coverage helped Minnesotans access care during the global pandemic, so really critical for continuity of care. It helped the state maintain high insurance coverage rates. It also allowed the state to receive billions of dollars of additional federal funding under the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, which was the first major federal stimulus package passed by Congress as the COVID pandemic began. It stipulated then, this federal law stipulated that continuous coverage provisions had to continue until the end of the federal COVID-19 public health emergency. So with continuous coverage in place, enrollment in the medical assistance and Minnesota Care programs has grown more than 330,000 people, or about 28%, to a total of 1.5 million people that are enrolled in the program. That's one in four Minnesotans are enrolled in our public health care programs. Congress, as Chair Noor indicated, Congress passed the Consolidated Appropriations Act at the end of 2022, right at the tail end, I think it was December 29th, which then within that package, it decoupled or untied the continuous coverage provisions from the end date of the federal public health emergency, which it had been tied to all along. So the change then in December instead, it ended continuous coverage effective on a date certain, March 31st, 2023. And with it, also a phase down of the full what was 6.2% increased federal medical assistance percentage funding. Eligibility redeterminations now may begin as early as April of 2023. So we have a date. Minnesota will follow this timeline and begin systems processing for renewals starting in April. And Minnesota remains eligible for that enhanced federal funding throughout 2023. It transitions down throughout the year, but stays in place as we work with all of the partners, including the federal partner CMS, our counties, put the renewal process back into place. So we'll start with just kind of highlighting a few of the renewal challenges. And again, it's because it's in this unique situation where everyone, as I say, everyone has to be touched within the system as we proceed forward. And we have a year to do that. Once we start that process, we have a year roughly a year. It goes about 14 months because there's little time for ensuring cleanup. And then by the summer, by June of 2024, I'll go through this timeline, but the June of 2024 then, the idea is that everything, the system is back. All cases have been renewed as appropriate, and we're back in on that path again. So since as the pandemic began, the number of enrollees has grown, as I indicated, and then so has the work necessary to complete renewals. With the continuous coverage requirements in place, the law required workers to refrain from acting. So when I say workers, that's the county workers. Counties do the medical assistance. Each county has a medical assistance eligibility function, and they do that first line, if you will, in that process. We are a state-supervised, county-administered process here in Minnesota. We're one of about 10 states that do it that way, and for the eligibility process. And then the Minnesota Care piece is handled through the state DHS through our staff. And we'll talk a bit about that distinction as well in terms of the timeline. And so as a result then of not being able to do the updates based on this, the federal funding and the federal requirement, the data on the files of the eligibility system, of course, has grown out of date in these two plus years, making the number of cases that automatically renew based on the data retrieved from various electronic databases, data then and that information that has been updated has really has risen up naturally, if you will. Resuming the renewal process will be particularly challenging because many of the enrollees will likely have moved. If you think about life in the past couple of years, right, 2-3 years, they have moved, they have gotten married, they've had a baby, they've every sort of imaginable that we all have experienced as well is very likely, and particularly with a Medicaid population, which experiences undoubtedly more than others. And the other challenge piece is around those who've gained coverage during the pandemic are unfamiliar with the renewal process. So it might be you got on, and you've never had to go through in this period of time, which is typically an annual process. You've never had to go through the renewal process and sort of all that lends itself to do in terms of the renewal. Also, newer workers that process renewals, as I mentioned, the county workers in particular, because that's the greatest workforce on the renewal piece. There might be new workers that have never done processing of renewals, so that's a very new function. Or it might be even though there are some seasoned, as I mentioned, eligibility workers tend to be a seasoned group. But those even those folks who do this work haven't had to touch this process for, 2-3 years. And so that also creates some out-of-date skill sets that we want to ensure training. So an unprecedented volume of renewals that need to be completed combined with the tight labor force. We are understanding counties, too, like a number of different sectors are experiencing worker shortages. And eligibility is of such a unique nature in knowing how to do this. It's something, yes, that can be trained, and yes, that's part of the job, and you come in, but it isn't where you can just plug and play someone. It's an extensive process to learn how to do eligibility renewals and how to work it within the system. Renewals in Minnesota are paper-based, so that's an important piece to this as well. It's a paper-based system, and it relies on postal mail. No capabilities currently exist for texting or emails or online eligibility management, like going in to update your address for enrollees, although that's part of the planning process and a lot of hard work going into that now to see how we can help move electronic capability along. Much of the everyday work performed by staff relies on a long, complex set of instructions to receive correct eligibility determinations, and significant IT needs And the reality of lack of funding over the years in IT infrastructure and system fixes and capability component pieces certainly have created a challenge. Similarly, systems then, you need strong systems to be able to produce data and reports and all the things that we are needing as we track all of this and keep everyone up to date on where we are. And then a high cost of public health care program coverage could cause an increase in uncompensated care and additional stress throughout our health care system, which, of course, as we all know, is recovering from the pandemic and worker shortages and other things. So when renewals, another challenge around this is when renewals resume, some enrollees will inevitably come off the public health care coverage because they no longer meet eligibility requirements. We know that. That's part of it. Some portion of enrollees, however, will remain in coverage but could lose it during that time, as Chair Noor indicated, during a factor of that's called basically a churn. Churn means you are on. And then you go off, you get your paperwork in or all the required documents, and then you go back on. The goal would be if you're sort of ultimately eligible, that we try to retain a level of consistency because that churn factor is really hard on people, and it also can cause gaps in care. And if you think of children, I'll talk about this, but 40% of the enrollees on public programs are children. That also is of concern. So that churn factor becomes a really important matter and a highlight. So we are working now to understand what the impact of that churn is. And there is nationally, the number that's used sort of on that national level is a Kaiser number that is out there. It's about 13% on average. But that may or may not factor in some of the churn rate. It's fair to say that this is still, we are still working through to understand this, and that's true across the nation. And I'm connected, for example, into the National Association of Medicaid Directors, which is it's kind of this small, tight group of 50-plus Medicaid directors around the country. And it's one of the challenge pieces of knowing what that number is, because we need to know that and we need to calibrate accordingly. So today, although I'll share with you that we're estimating in Minnesota it's between 15% and 25% of people who will drop. But of those that may drop, so remember the base is 1.5 million, that about 25% to 50% of those people will resume coverage within that year to then ensure coverage for them. But again, churn isn't necessarily an alternative or a happy alternative. Matter. We want to try to retain and create a level of consistency. The loss of coverage, I'll just speak the obvious here just for, I guess, to emphasize the point that we all know. The loss of coverage in Minnesotans can impact COVID vaccines, immunizations, screening, prescription drugs that typically at that very point of sale, if you will, at the pharmacy, that also can be very stressful for the enrollee who maybe that coverage piece is not continuing. And it just sort of highlighting, not to be dramatic at all, but to highlight that level of reality that happens in the lives of people who count on public programs for their health coverage. And those negative impacts may worsen existing health disparities in Minnesota. As I mentioned, we cover over 40% of Minnesota children in our, it's such a point of pride, I think. We cover 40% of children in public programs. We cover 4 out of 10 births in Minnesota. That's pretty staggering. And of course, elderly and people with disabilities are covered under public programs in a great number. Enrollees are disproportionately Black, Indigenous, or people of color compared to the general population. And as we know, just adding this on to what is already disparities in our health outcomes in Minnesota is problematic. Okay, so, thank you for highlighting all the negatives. Now let's talk through then. All right, what's the plan and what are we working on and how are we addressing and getting ready for what is ahead of us? We have created some guiding principles. You'll see the kind of three circles there. And it's, of course, maintain. So our principles are maintaining coverage for all eligible enrollees without interruptions, complying with what is evolving federal guidance. I will say that we work daily. One of my jobs as a state Medicaid director is to be very connective and have very strong relationships with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, who is our parent agency under the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And they too are working through evolving guidance. And so as they convey that down to states, that kind of keeping track of that and working that through, understanding what that means and understanding what had been in place under the COVID a couple of years here, and then what anything new comes forward is understanding even the intersection and interaction of those guidance pieces. So this is what DHS does. We do policy work and policy analysis, and all of that is a big part of this, but it's a critical piece, and I highlight it because it isn't as easy as you pick up a book and it tells you exactly what to do. You've got to figure that out a bit more. And the last, then, if you will, of our guiding principles is minimizing the burden on the counties. It's probably one of the things I care about, or I worry about the most, is that level of that frontline component piece with 87 counties who do the eligibility work for medical assistance, which is the bigger program of our two public programs, Medicaid and Minnesota Care, and ensuring then that we are, of course, hand in hand with them as well, and working through then our work with them to help support them. So I'll go into a bit of data and ask maybe even my friend and colleague Karen to help me this if I don't get it quite right, because she's has a level of expertise around this. But as you, it's a little bit busy on this graph, but. Here's at a high level, here's what we're doing. So we have worked this through with CMS on, we are taking the medical assistance, again, the Medicaid population, and we are taking it and dividing it into 12 cohorts, so which means every month, basically, for 12 months, that we will work through then that chunk of enrollment that needs to be reinstituted and, or renewed. And that then helps us balance that work. It helps the counties, more importantly, balance that work, and then also gives opportunity to help and aid counties and work hand in hand as the state, work hand in hand with counties on that. You'll see on the graph, my eyes are probably not that great to see it across the room there, but you'll see sort of the numbers are fairly consistent for that, then that 1/12 cohort approach. That bump that you see starting in December, January, February, that reflects then the Minnesota Care component that gets added onto that. As I mentioned, Minnesota Care renewals are handled exclusively by the state, by our state staff. Karen has a colleague, Tammy Smith, who runs that area for DHS, again, long service person. And they then will be focused on that Minnesota Care. We've got permission to be able to keep the Minnesota Care renewal piece to the what is typical to do it at an open enrollment process in the fall. That then helps us sort of, it's not that staff sits around and does nothing, I just want to point that out, but it helps us then manage a focus and intent to help support counties as we start the renewal process in the first months. Honestly, the hope is that as we learn more and as we start this cohort role, we certainly will learn a lot more and learn the bumps and that may come through that, but I think it's a really sound and responsible approach, and CMS agreed with us as well. Karen, I'll just ask you spontaneously, is there anything else we should highlight on there? Maybe if you could talk about how the renewals are household-based, that might be helpful to know.
Certainly. We do cases for renewals. So they are, so if a family is on, parents are maybe on a case along with their children, the whole household is renewed at one time. So the coverage is sort of looked at one time. There is a little bit of an exception to that. Sometimes people apply for their children before they apply for themselves, so they might have their children eligible for the medical assistance program, and then later they, as the parents, decide, I should try and apply for coverage for myself, and they might wind up on Minnesota Care based on income and other eligibility factors. So we do have about 42,000 mixed household cases where the renewals are at different times. It is our intention to take those cases and process them at the state and then thus relieve the county of the burden of those cases. It will help us, I think, too, with when it's time to renew Minnesota Care, which is, as Cynthia mentioned, is done one time in the fall, and it does create a bit of a spike there for us.
Thank you. Some of the question, and sometimes a question has arisen in our work on this is, are you prioritizing a certain group of people? How are you making the determination on who ends up in that 112th group? And just to be very clear on that, so again, the typical process is you apply, you have an annual then renewal date based on that date. So it's every year. You would typically go through that cycle. And so that's how this 112th cohort piece gets broken out. It's by your annual annual enrollment application date. And so in case that comes up, because there has been some discussion of if there's way to pivot this to maybe look at it in a different way. But here's the reality of our systems. I mentioned our systems function, and they work well. It's the METS system. They work well for how we do things. I mean, generally well how we do things, but it this is a unique challenge piece. So keeping it in a consistent process, the counties will feel that consistency. Again, they generally know how to do that. And I say generally just because, again, there may be new workers. But that is also gives a sense of regularity about the process that helps to stabilize. So let's move into talking about the timeline. Generally, it's, you know, a fairly high-level timeline, but to give you a sense of that. So it's important to keep in mind, as I said, we've been working this whole effort since 2020. And then we've had that whole period of 21 and 20, the years of 2021 and 2022, where we dealt with 11 different public health emergency extensions. So there's been a start and stop process along this as the COVID pandemic worked itself through. And, you know, and then so we would get an extension. That's not a bad thing. It gives just more time to prepare for readiness. But it does then, having a concrete date does help us then with, you know, that kind of stake in the ground of being able to say, here's the date. All right. And here's our plan. And here's going forward. Assuming that CMS guidance for the Consolidated Appropriation Act continues to be consistent with prior federal guidance, which we believe it will, we are anticipating that our unwind will begin with July renewal, so July of 2023, with our first cohort. And so we continue to meet with CMS to review our plan and understand certainly any further guidance. Just last week, more guidance came out. So it's a continual learning process, again, federally as well. And so notifications for enrollees in cohort one, so that's that first group of the 12, will begin in March. And when we begin sending enrollees a pre-renewal notice, to inform them that the process is restarting for them. The systems processing for that cohort one group begins in April. So the notice is in March. The system processing begins in April within our system. May is when the renewal forms get sent out. You can feel a little bit of process around this, right? And then the first cohort date where you could potentially lose coverage, and this is a critical date to know, is July 1st. So that could be the first time that we see people begin to drop from coverage. So then we go on, we conduct notifications and processing similarly then for all the rest of the cohort groups in the same way through June of 2024. And then, as I mentioned, Minnesota Care notifications and processing will take place in the fourth quarter of 2023. And then that unwind is expected to be completed by May of 2024. So let's talk about then the components of the plan. I like to put things in sort of pillars or boxes to try to group these component pieces of our plan. So we've got six pillars. There's a lot to each pillar, but six pillars within each plan. And I realize these slides are a little busy. I certainly won't work through each of these unless you'd like that or unless there are questions. But I'd like to just sort of highlight then these pillars. So first I'll just kind of run through them in terms of their label. So the first is around program policy and training. And when I say policy, that would be understanding the federal policy, the federal guideline around that, understanding state-directed policy from the legislature. A number of pieces as we work through and basically explain the program and then work with counties to understand that that policy. And then within that program and policy training becomes really important. I mentioned that, but we spend a lot of time. We've got dedicated people working to train on the complexity of eligibility and train with counties, train our own staff, but also train with counties as well. So it's a very large and big effort. Let's see. So that's a bit of highlight of what we mean by program policies. Or maybe I should say also we issue bulletins, guidance bulletins out to counties. That's a big part of work. All of that's organized and orchestrated. Again, it's not new. We've done it for I don't know how many years, since Medicaid maybe has been around. And so that all of that is part of the construct of how all this works and is organized together. So moving on to the second pillar then, really critical pieces around measures and data. Keeping track of this, ensuring that we have a track on it, we report a track to you on where we are. Counties have the ability to have a tracking mechanism. And also, not the last but not least, would be reporting to the federal government, because that's a very big piece of the requirement to continue but you have to do it anyway under the Medicaid program, but also to continue the funding component through this, through the unwinding work. So working on measurement and data and being able to bring that forward, we have created a structure. It's called an incident command structure, and it is one used through the COVID work. And so it's really building upon that. It created the COVID work done within other state agencies led by the Department of Health. Really is a blueprint opportunity for us to take this. This is really now, it's really part of that COVID continuum, but it's getting to that closure level piece. So using all the materials and ideas and thoughts they had to drill into how we do this is also very, very critical. And working closely within our state partners, with our state colleagues. So we have, for instance, a monthly group. It's called the Interagency Advisory Team, or, you know, like we like to label things with acronyms, so it's IAT. And so it is a group of all the agencies, I think it's about 8 agencies that touch healthcare and have a responsibility for that and come together so we can also do this across the enterprise of the state to be highly connected, which, again, of course, is one of the learnings, if you will, of the COVID work. The third pillar is around system readiness, another very critical piece. We certainly understand the importance of assessing the capacity of the systems and making configurations to support resumption of renewals. So this includes reviewing system capacity, making updates where required, and developing testing plans that have to be submitted to CMS. Our Medicaid and Minnesota Care programs, as I mentioned, are paper-based in terms of the renewal process. So we're looking and pushing along to find more ways. So, for instance, texting. It sounds, you know, texting is part of our modern day, but in the Medicaid space within our system, that is something that will be new to the program, and we are hoping to be able to launch that soon. Looking at ways where we can improve the auto renewal rate and also form simplification. This is sort of the, if you will, the unsexy part of the core program function pieces, but they're also critical foundationally in this work around renewals. Also, so key to this is supporting counties and tribes to ensure they are prepared to resume, and also really critical working with MNsure as well. So we create sort of a runway and a pathway into, so if people drop from medical assistance or Minnesota care coverage, that there's a pathway in. We work very closely every day with our MNsure colleagues to ensure that there is an opportunity for people to be picked up through MNsure as appropriate. And also working and discussing with the opportunities around perhaps commercial coverage, because there might be people then that have their change of circumstance, maybe a job, and it might be that there is some opportunity for coverage elsewhere. A fourth pillar is around, again, I guess I'm saying everyone is critical, but they are, I guess, everyone. But this is a really critical one, and that is the communication component piece. So ensuring what is a focus for CMS, but certainly for us, for the counties, for the health plans who are helping support this as well, this work, the communication couldn't be more important. And if you recall, I mentioned the disparities, the communities within the Medicaid program, really critical that we get out literally to the ground level, if you will, to be able to ensure that people know what's coming, understand what is needed. It starts with an address. We need your updated address, and it goes from there in terms of providing detailed information. So that takes a very large communication effort and plan. I'll talk a little bit more about that coming up here. That is a high focus piece. And also, it's really important that we sort of speak in one voice. So there's the messaging is clear. We're all speaking on that messaging, and everyone is understanding then what is needed, everyone meaning within the system and the processing entities that do this work that we hold together. Enrollee support, of course, critical. That probably should be listed as number one. But supporting enrollees as we continue to explore how best to use data and the partnerships with managed care plans in this state hold about 85% of our Medicaid and Minnesota Care enrollment, so they're a critical player to our work. And then certainly other organizations, community organizations, et cetera. We meet, Karen and I, and a large team of our DHS team in healthcare meet every other Thursday morning. We hold stakeholder sessions, three sessions. We meet with counties and tribes, we meet with health plans, and then we meet with provider community organizations to ensure that we are conveying this information out in a very regular process and allow, we call it Medicaid Roundtable, and it allows then the opportunity for engagement. And there, it's a very engaging and important venue for us. And that would be just one example of how we connect on this. There are many, many opportunities. Karen and team lead with the counties, for example, to work together and talk this through. Finally, I guess that's my lead into the county and tribal pillar, where we are developing a support plan to support the counties. We call it I warned you that I do like numbers and to categorize it. So this is a 10-point support plan. We'd add more numbers if we need to, but a 10-point support plan for county support. And we continue to as I mentioned, lots of venues with counties and tribes, but a recent example is just a listening session we held two Fridays ago, maybe, a listening session with counties just to ensure that we're keeping track and ensuring that we've got as many counties as possible and county directors and also their eligibility teams connecting and have the opportunity to not only keep up to date, but also ask questions and tell us what's working, what's not working, and create ideas as well. So the next two slides then go through, I won't walk through every piece of the 10-point plan for county support, but you'll see things like we talked about training, we talked about the venues to collaborate, system support component pieces, customizable assets, as it's called, in the communications area, but customizable, and I'll show you, probably in the next slide, I'll show you some of those assets, our communications as part of our toolkit on communications. And customizable meaning you can, as a county, you can take it and use it and say, you know, X County can put their label on it, or we can co-label or whatever. All of that is not as important as getting that message out. But we're really trying to make it very accessible and create that opportunity for counties to use, again, in a one-voice sort of mode. We also are evaluating the opportunity for our staff. We don't have a large staff that does our Minnesota Care work, but how we can help and support them, support counties, particularly counties maybe that don't have very large staffs. It tends to be rural counties. Maybe there's one or two people that do that. And so making sure that they know they have a venue in and a level of support from the state team. And last, but I don't think least at all, which is this is going to be a stressful time. It's, again, just extra work, right? And so we want to take care of our team that does this, these county workers that do eligibility, and our state workers, too, very valuable people. Recognizing and taking care of them on a wellness level is also something that we are working to build into our plan. I mentioned communications and how important that is, and the slide probably doesn't do it justice in terms of these, but I will say beautiful documents. I didn't create them, so I can say that. They are created by our small but mighty communications team within DHS with lots of input from lots of other stakeholders. So we'll talk about then how this and other things are being used, as I mentioned, on that really critical pillar around communication. So we, of course, have phases, five phases on the communication piece. Again, we'll add more if needed. But phase one has really been a focus on just getting the address updated. So it's an effort to update addresses, and it's a multi-channel continuous public awareness effort. Multi-channel meaning we are in newspapers and all kinds of different media pieces to be able to reach deep into community. Public television, TPT, did a piece, worked with us on some things. Digital banner. I mean, there's a list of things. I probably can't do it justice to list everything, but very aware of the social media component. And then we have communication toolkits that can be provided, and certainly would offer that to any constituent on a constituent level that you may have, or that an opportunity we might have of anyone you know within your constituency that would benefit by having that information. So then a phase two is more around than actually talking about the renewal information with enrollees. And one of the things we discussed was, heavily discussed, is do you go out with a big old, big message to everyone, and then you create, though, this fervor of perhaps anxiety around that, or are you better to go in this 1/12th cohort piece, and that way you do just-in-time messaging around that. So the address campaign was a broader approach, but then once we get to the eligibility, it's your time to be, you know, renewed and reevaluated for renewal. That's that just-in-time sort of approach, so we can then provide, counties in particular can provide that information to that cohort group, and hopefully not be as overwhelmed as they otherwise might be if all of a sudden we did a messaging out and there were calls coming in to counties that just couldn't, frankly, it'd be very difficult to handle 1.5 million calls on this thing if you look at it dramatically. So then moving into just quickly on phase three is about just the strengthening the communication, keeping that very critical piece around timelines and focusing on those timelines and resuming renewals, because it's kind of a continued strengthening piece of that. Phase four then is as the renewals actually begin, ensuring that we're tracking and focused on targeted outreach on a continual level. And then the so-called phase five then will focus heavily on that, ensuring that transition to Minsure or other products that may be available to people. So these pieces will be very active as within each cohort group as we work through them. So it will be a continual sort of process. So then this is where I go into just a bit on what are the proposals then that we have in place then as to help support our plan and our planning process and to help, again, ensure that coverage is in place. So just to note that restarting renewals, while we know it's going to be a big challenge, the Secretary of Health and Human Services has indicated, U.S. Secretary has indicated that this is one of the greatest efforts since the rollout of the Affordable Care Act. And that was a major effort. Actually, I worked at CMS at the time, so it was a very major effort across the nation, and we, of course, in Minnesota felt that as well. So DHS has put forth some proposals in the legislative process in this session through the governor's budget to seek to help keep people eligible in Minnesota, to retain access. And these are resources. You've heard me kind of go through some of the challenge pieces. And so these proposals then help support and directly go to those challenge pieces. And respectfully stated, if the legislature can act to help us get those resources earlier rather than later, that's going to help us in the process. So we use those dollars and those policy changes to be able to support the critical nature as we begin this process starting in April. Since the beginning of the pandemic, the state has received a net amount. I mentioned that federal participation level, the 6.2% enhanced FMAP, as it's called, the federal financial participation level. We have a net of about $1.8 billion of enhanced federal funding that came as a result of that additional funding. So this $1.8 billion represents the total value of the enhanced federal funding minus the cost of continuing coverage for individuals that have been on the program. And the February forecast is expected to recognize, will indicate that federal funding. So DHS is seeking to use some of this money to ease the transition issues when the renewals resume. There's three pieces here that we'll highlight here, and Karen will probably ask you to help me with one of these as I set it up a little. But there's a critical couple components here as well. So medical assistance enrollees who have disabilities, are blind, or are 65 or older have to meet asset limits to renew their coverage. And because they may have accrued assets more than normal during this last 2 to 3 years, these vulnerable enrollees could lose coverage due at renewal time and quickly spend the assets and have to reapply and be determined eligible again. This churn, again, that word churn, could result in gaps in coverage, disruptions in care, stress for enrollees and their caretakers, and strained providers and eligibility workers as well. So the kind of the healthcare system as a whole. And of course, this is probably the most vulnerable population component piece. So we wanted to go through a process to try through a piece of legislation to help us be able to do something a little differently for this population. So there's a proposal then that gives enrollees extra time to spend down assets accumulated in the pandemic and eliminates unnecessary hurdles that will cause that churn component piece and make things more stable for individuals that, again, are disabled, blind, 65 or older in that population group. Karen, I don't know if there's anything else you would add to that to support that at all.
I think we're okay.
Okay, very good. That means I covered it really well, and I'm becoming an expert in eligibility. So moving on then, another proposal is ensuring that eligible Minnesotans keep coverage. So navigator organizations, I'm not sure if you've heard of navigator organizations. They're a very critical part to the substructure of the medical assistance program, particularly for the eligibility process. And so they play a really critical role in Minnesotans applying for public health care programs as well as renewing their coverage. And frankly, I think it's also in explaining coverage and the system itself. So navigators receive payment for each medical assistance and Minnesota care enrollment that they assist with. and it's via grant funds. And this payment model causes navigators to lose funding when continuous coverage provisions were in place and the volume of applications dropped during that time. So their viability, if you will, is dependent then on that enrollment piece. That's what it's tied to. So navigator organizations will receive added funding then to help enrollees through renewal paperwork. And I'm here to say, and I'm not the only one saying this, that the navigator piece is really, really critical to our process. And a third legislative proposal in the governor's budget is this is around again ensuring coverage. So the proposal strengthens support to restart renewals with administrative resources that includes temporary staffing, overtime pay, additional vendor support, increased printing, postage. It's sort of the guts, if you will, of that administrative work that has to be done. By and large, it's AFSCME employees. It's people that we really want to help support who are running that day-to-day process around this work. The proposals also allow the Department of Human Services Commissioner Harpstead in this case, to have as much flexibility as allowed under federal law to temporarily adjust to ensure a timely renewal process or avoid bottlenecks as necessary. So it's not an unbridled area of focus, but it is around there. Maybe there's some tweak pieces or maybe there's some opportunity for us to do some common sense component pieces, again, all under the guise of federal requirements. That allow us to be able to ensure coverage, that coverage and continues, and particularly to try to move bottleneck component pieces out of the way. Looking ahead, and this is my last slide, I believe. Looking ahead, so where are we going, and what are some next steps, if you will? The situation, it's fair to say it continues to evolve through, it is just the way it is. And we have worked diligently and hard, as I mentioned, through all of this to ensure all that we can, understand all that we can, and drive, I'm a big driver, so drive forward all that we can in the construct of this big effort ahead. More guidance will continue to come out from CMS as it figures out the Consolidated Appropriations Act, for example, the law that passed at the end of December, and we're working hard to understand their guidance. But it's important to say, as I started in the outset, we know how to do renewals. Counties know how to do renewals. We know how to connect and work together. But it's been a while. We're a little rusty. But working really hard to get back at it, but also dealing with the level of reality of our system and other pieces that are part of the construct of how we need to problem solve. Communications, as I probably overemphasize that, but deliberately, that communications are critical, not only just the tangible work products that we're creating, but also working with the government, the other agencies, the counties, tribes, and then working with CMS as well. And so, of course, we want to continue to work closely with you as legislators and as you hear from your constituents, from your counties. That would be something I would be want to be very tapped into to ensure that we are connected together. And I'm a middle child of a very large family, so I do that naturally. That level of collaboration, that we connect together, is really how we win on this ultimately. So again, respectfully asking for the consideration of helping us add to our work, support our work. By moving our unwinding work, unwinding proposals, through the legislative process timely. So that's a lot of me talking, and so thank you for that opportunity, and certainly Karen, especially expert Karen, and I will be able to respond to questions as you would like, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much, Assistant Commissioner. I think using the words that you used, unprecedented. No, this is a significant undertaking. 1.5 million renewal that needs to be done in a short time, period, which we're used to the system picking up on a continuous process. So looking at the numbers, I see more than 200,000 potentially could lose their eligibility based on the numbers that I'm hearing right now. I know that that is a significant number. Maybe you will correct me on that because we don't know how many, but we also need to anticipate based on what we know. And quite frankly, there's a lot of questions in terms of how we can help and guide so we are able to do this. And you also stated that this will be one of the significant undertakings since the ACA, which is really critical for us to understand the challenges that we're going to be facing as a state. If this is not one of the most important issue within the department, I don't know what is. I know in the long-term care, if individuals are ineligible through this process, they cannot, you know, take them off from their list just simply because they are not eligible for Medicaid. We're talking about thousands of individuals who may be sending the SMART review to the state who may have been eligible in a different format now that they want to continue with the eligibility. Likewise, I think I wanted to know more about how can we tap into the continuous coverage. We're talking about the 12-month period where the kids now under the new federal law covers them for 12 months. As we see people are falling out, how can we protect those kids so they can continue to take advantage of the program that we've been given through the ACA? I've got lots of questions. I'll come back to those. I just wanted to let the members ask those questions. Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you, Assistant Commissioner McDonald. So a couple things, as I had gone out to Wright County and just saw their process and just heard, you know, their bells were like alarming and how they're gonna do the unwinding. And their biggest concern was their DOS system and how to get a hold of people. And just with workers. And so again, I asked back in January, just like how many of your employees are currently still, you know, at home working like in a hybrid situation, and how many full-time employees are out in the force? Would you happen to know that?
I don't know if
I think that is more for the operations. And we've asked that question of the. Are you talking about the county or the state?
I'm talking about these guys, the state, at the state level. I asked about the state level, and I still haven't gotten that answer since January. So it just kind of would help me understand the process on how that would work. And so wondering if I could get that information at some point, or if there's somebody's in the audience that would know that.
I think that is noted, and I think we'll get a follow-up in how the how many individuals you know, telecommuting at this point. Is that the question, how many individuals?
So that's part of it. And so can I just ask one more quick question around this? The other thing that kind of struck me, too, is you talked about the postage piece of it.
Yeah.
So are you doing all of your communications currently with 1.5 million participants? Some are families, so there could be five would maybe get one piece of postage. Is it all done via postage currently right now that you said, or... are there, you know, are they getting direct deposit? Are they getting a direct deposit? Are they getting, like, an email, things like that currently? Or did you say you're primarily earlier on in the conversation you said you're a paper-based system. So is it all paper-based, or are you partially paper-based or not? And that's what the county was saying, is that the only way that they would know if people also still met eligibility, there was deaths that had happened, you know, people may have passed away, or they had moved and they still were on assistance, but they wouldn't know because of the tracking. So that's my question is, you said you're a paper-based system, but then is there any way that you're doing anything electronically or not right now?
I just wanted to add to that piece. I think we're talking about, thank you so much for, you're talking about the notices that are going to be sent. Maybe this committee should go visit the IOC. I'm hoping that it's still functional because Medicaid, it's more based on the individual as we had from the assistant commissioner. So the whole family, you know, different eligibility, different things.
Oh, yeah.
Every process, there'll be a notice sent to to that individual. Yeah. I know you talked about how will that continue based online. And the workers at the county level, they have access to see the notices that are being generated. And if they don't get it, they will also be able to see that. I just wanted to add on that as part of the question that you're asking. Likewise, I think you talked about the data that we get from Social Security and other entities as we look into whether it's SSI income from different other groups, whether it's somebody who has passed away. I think all that data is being captured and sent. The reason that I know is I used to upload and make sure that that data is available to the workers to some extent when I worked for the department. So, Representative Gilmore, you wanted to add something else?
Well, so my question really isn't answered, though, about it. Is it electronically happening? And because if you, the direct deposit, because, so you did that, and you did that data collection, and you were physically there doing the data collection. That's what my question is as well from January, is are people in doing that amazing data collection, and is it happening? So currently, it'd be very easy to know if there is direct deposit happening. If there's something happening monthly, on a monthly basis, prescriptions being paid, there's, or is 1.5 million people, so then it would be pared down because it's families, still doing what the assistant commissioner said is it's a paper-based system. That's what I'm wondering.
So to the assistant commissioner, the diary deposit may be more on the whether we're paying for prescriptions and Medicaid, because I know this is not a benefit cash-based. So please proceed.
That's correct, Chairman Noor and Representative. Yeah, there is not as indicated, there's not a direct deposit in the health care program. That's probably more in the income-based program pieces, so that's not a factor here. But as to your base question is, so what does it mean to be paper-based, and how does it sort of work and function? I know, Karen, I might ask you to explain that. Probably better than I could do, but.
Yes, Chair and Representative. So for the 1.5 million enrollees, I believe that equates to about 840,000 cases. So for each of those cases, there would be a renewal form that would be done for our families with kids and our adults without dependents, non-elderly, non-disabled. Our system will attempt to do what's referred to as auto-renew the case using our available electronic data sources. So the individual won't have to do anything. The system has access to certain data sources, as mentioned, Social Security Administration, Equifax, which has some employer information, and I think we also have some information from the Internal Revenue Service. So the system will try to renew eligibility for that population of folks, because of course our data has we haven't acted on adverse changes other than death if it has been reported, somebody's no longer a state resident or voluntarily requested the case, because those are generally reasons that were permitted closure reasons that have occurred throughout the last couple of years. So if the system can auto-renew somebody, the information compared is, based on what we get from the updated electronic sources, the person will get a notice mailed to them saying they have auto-renewed. That notice is available to them in their online account through METS. They can see it, but we also mail them. For those that don't auto-renew, they will be sent a paper renewal form. We're kind of kicking off the process with a pre-renewal notice that will go out a few weeks before they can expect to receive their renewal form, letting them know it's coming, what they need to do, how they can get help, who can help them with the paperwork and the forms. Then the renewal form will come, and they will hopefully comply and fill out the form returning renewals. We are, as Assistant Commissioner McDonald mentioned, we're working on developing our text messaging capabilities. We don't have those in place yet, but we are working on developing those. We're also working to develop for that population so that they could actually do their renewal online. It is going to be a while. That's not ready yet, but that is in the development process.
Thank you. So one quick question to you then, Karen. So when you say it's a, so in, I think it's like in April, did you say that you're going to do a pre or May, April or May, something like that? You're going to do like a, hey, coming up in March or June?
Yep. Chair and Representative, first, that first group that we call the July renewals, they will get a pre-renewal notice in March. We'll be mailing those out in March.
So you're going to mail out 840,000? Or no, you'll mail out 100,000 for that first cohort?
Yeah, whatever the first cohort is.
It's about, Representative, it's about, it's on that graph, and I'm sorry, I just don't know the number off the top of my head. It's about 60.
Chair and Representative, yeah, I think it's approximately 60,000.
Across the state, of course, yeah. So all counties.
Okay, so I just, thank you, Chair. So I basically, I don't know if I got the paper-based system thing figured out. I don't know what that means. And so I don't, you did it in your presentation, so that's what was really alarming to me. So do you know what that, what you, when you said it was, we are a paper-based system, Chair, our commissioner, what does that mean? I'm just wondering.
To have Director Gibson?
What?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I mean, basically, it is getting renewal forms mailed by U.S. Postal Service, and then you will take those papers from there, you know, and fill them out, complete them, and return, for example, with proof of income, and return them back to your processing agency.
Yeah. Director Gibson, I'm assuming that's the combined application that goes. Is it just a simple renewal?
Mr. Chair, it's a renewal form. It's not the combined application. It is a specific renewal form.
So for those who are, you know, who are receiving SNAP or MFIP or other program as part of the renewal, are we going to capture that with just a simple renewal process? Or are we going to send the recertification for that?
Mr. Chair, because of the Medicaid requirements that we have to follow, they might not align with when somebody has a renewal for SNAP or a cash program. However, after they've completed their renewal for medical assistance, for example, the SNAP and cash renewal date can be aligned to that. So in the future going forward, it could be done at the same time. We are permitting the use of verifications of income that may have been provided, for example, to SNAP and cash. I think if it's not more than 6 months old, they've already provided it, that's fine. We can use that.
So then, Chair, at that point when you collected data, and I'm just wondering if this is how it is right now, do you take those paper forms and then scan them in and warehouse them, or do you have file cabinets of 840,000 applications?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, the larger counties will have document management systems where they will scan, index, put them in a work queue for workers to work. Probably many of the medium-sized county, some of the smaller ones might not have that capability, but most of the larger counties do have that. And like I said, I believe most of the medium-sized counties do as well. At DHS for the Minnesota care cases, they do have a system by which they scan and index. There isn't a statewide EDMS system. It is each processing entity would have their own.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gilman. I think you noted what some of the challenges the counties are facing. They don't have document management system. So with this funding that we have to think about the smaller counties so they're able to catch up and to provide that information in a digital format. So, Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you so much for being here today. Couple of things. So one is just a comment. I just sort of want to give a preview that I'm hoping to have a bill that I drop to address some of the limits and assets for individuals with disabilities and seniors. They're the only protected class group that has a different requirement than non-people with disabilities and not seniors. And so if anybody wants to sign on to that, let me know. And then my second question was around the unwinding package and kind of what you have for staff and what you're looking at for staff. I think sometimes it can be easy to think, oh, you said small and mighty communications team. So when you say small and mighty, how small?
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative, so within DHS, we have a central communications team that sort of is, you know, kind of broadly based across. And then there are dedicated folks into, it sounds like you know this, but then dedicated into the administrations. And as you know, we're divided into administrations. I run the healthcare administration, which is the largest of the administrations. And so the communication support pieces, we pick up communication support then. We have an individual who then is assigned to us as an expert communications person. And then we also have communication people that live within our provider, and I'm losing the name of MPPS, the provider enrollment area, right? So there's communication pieces within that. So for instance, communicating to the counties or communicating bulletins out, that kind of thing. But that, you know, the creative strategic kind of component piece that this requires then also draws from other communication experts around the state. I mentioned that IAT group, the interagency advisory team, where we're tapping into 7 or 8 other state agencies. So those communication folks within those agencies then are connective into kind of a centralized coordinated process within there. But it's not large.
Thank you, Chair. And my purpose for asking is because, you know, supporting the unwinding, I think it's important for the committee to understand how bare bones things currently are. So when we talk about FTEs, when we talk about what's needed, actually understanding what that looks like in practice. And so I'm going to grab onto the little piece of what you said. One communication person in the healthcare administration who's helping coordinate with all of those other outside other pieces. So I want to kind of point that out, that that is the kind of workload we are putting on folks to do this kind of work. And then subsequent to that, when we talk about the outreach and the engagement with counties and even the direct processing of applications, how many folks are we talking about that are currently doing that work and that you maybe need to do that work?
Assistant Commissioner.
Do you know the navigator?
Mr. Chair, Representative, so I was just asking Karen about, because there is the navigator kind of component piece, so there's some support pieces within there. But I'm not here to argue with you at all that it's a very small team. So in terms of that outreach piece and the communication, that gets encompassed within the few individuals that focus on communication pieces, but also programmatically, some of Karen's team might work on some of that messaging, for example. We also have brought in a contractor. We've brought in Deloitte to help us with this. Deloitte works with about 31 other states on unwinding activities in one form or another. So they are working with us to be able to not only determine our readiness, but also coordinate our planning process, so heavy project planning. And then also then looking at where do we need to supplement some of this work. But of course, if we have them, it costs money, of course, to be able to do that, right? So to be able to tap into state employee resources to be able to do that would be, in my view, a wise idea of spend. And also that level of expertise that's right in your program area that is able to understand these programs and understand kind of that key message piece. So on that outreach, your question, though, is around outreach and how many. I would call it a team, a small team. It's also tapping into the other agencies who can help support that, but it's small.
I'll now go to Representative Lee New Burnley. We've got several members on the list, so just wanted to make sure that people are aware we've got a few minutes left.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Assistant Commissioner. My questions relate primarily to the interactions with the counties. You know, I'm trying to figure out how to minimize my questions, Mr. Chair. But I guess let's talk about the county support plan first. So you have this series of 10 sort of tools in this county support plan.
What of these tools exist currently, or is DHS going to need to develop this entire plan from scratch?
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, let me just pull that up. Actually, Karen, can you flip that slide back, perhaps? See if I can. So maybe if you'd like, maybe I can just talk through this plan. So the training opportunities, we have trainers. We have a staff. It's by and large state staff. It's part of the Karen runs the eligibility policy and program area. We have also, I mentioned Tammy Smith, who runs the eligibility operations area. That includes the Minnesota Care program as well. That's where that training lies, is in that operations group. I don't think I can tell you today how many trainers there are with that, but it's an available number. But that's up and running, and there's a level of expertise around that. Venues to collaborate, those are all already existing, and we are always looking for new opportunities to connect in and all of that. So that's a very natural part of our work together with counties. I may have to rely on Karen Gibson here a little bit on the One Source and HealthQuest component piece, if you're able to do that.
Sure. Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. OneSource currently exists. It is an online tool available to workers. It contains instructions and procedures that they need to follow when processing applications, renewals, etc. There is work, of course, because we are just getting guidance from CMS. So not everything is done, finalized. There will be work that needs to be put out on One Source that is in progress. Will have to maybe be revised or updated depending on the information that CMS provides. We are working on an FAQ for workers relative to this. That is not completed yet because of some of the other pieces we're waiting to finish up and what have you. HealthQuest currently exists where county workers can submit to us a case question that seems to be outside normal parameters, kind of unusual. It's like, we don't come across the circumstance all the time. We're not sure how to apply the rules. Can you advise? Can you give us some guidance and direction? That currently exists today. System support is currently existing. We do have a team. Again, this would be in my colleague's area, Tammy Smith's shop. The healthcare eligibility system support is there to help workers if they run into some systems issues with METS. Just they have to report, it seems like the performance, something's strange, can you check it out? Or I entered this in the system and I didn't get the result I expected. Can you have somebody take a look at that? So they can submit trouble tickets, so that exists today. Moving on, if I can, okay. So the long-term care policy support, we do provide that largely through the HealthQuest process today, but we are hoping to see if we can delve into that a little bit deeper and develop something there. So that's in progress. That's an area that's really quite complex for workers. It gets into some difficult issues, I think, relative to annuities, possible transfers of assets, and other things that are a little more complicated. And so we are looking to see if we can provide that. That's there. Unwinding dashboards are in development. We have shared them with county staff to get some feedback, input, and et cetera. So we are working on that. There is a concern, we know, because of the way our systems work and our data warehouse where we get refreshed data monthly. Ideally, they would like real-time data, which ideally we would like to give to them, but I think the way our systems are set up in the data warehouse, the way it works, it's my understanding, once it's refreshed monthly, we can update that data, but we can't. I don't believe we're able to provide them real-time data. We've mentioned the customizable assets and communication toolkits. Those are available now. We have shared those with counties. Help with processing renewals. Currently, they don't have to they don't need help. We're not really doing renewals at this particular time. We are running cases through the system, through our MET system, just to see if there are some individuals we can auto-renew currently. But other than that, renewals aren't occurring. So Tammy and her team have committed that they will do the mixed household cases when renewals resume. So when there's a family member on MA and then another one is on Minnesota Care, for example, child on MA, Minnesota Care, they'll process those cases so that that will take a little bit of burden off of the counties on those cases. The staff wellness and recognition program is yet to be developed yet. That is not available at this point in time.
Lead Mayor Brindley.
Thank you so much. That was incredibly helpful and insightful. So it looks like most of these things exist currently in some form. With that unwinding dashboard, that would be sort of a new procedure. You said that the data can only be updated monthly based on how you receive data. Can you talk a little bit about how that works in practice for the counties? What is their timeline for completing renewals? What kind of information are they going to garner from that dashboard that is critical to them completing renewals?
Thank you, Chair and Representative. There are a couple different things even beyond the dashboard. The dashboard, I think, will indicate to them how many cases are, you know, due for renewal in a particular month, how many individuals are due for a renewal in a particular month. I believe it breaks it down by population group. So, for example, medical assistance for people 65 and older, or people 60 who have a disability, children, parents, families, those kinds of things. So that dashboard will be there. But there are other reports. I'm probably not the best person to talk about the other reports that we have for them too. They're termed Bobby reports. I think that's a system where they can get them, which gives a little more information. So we may need to follow up with that. I'm probably not the report expert on that.
Final follow-up. I'll leave
you. Oh gosh, I
get you going.
So. Mr. Chair, I'd like to dig into this a little bit further. Are the counties going to need access to this dashboard to complete renewals, or is the dashboard just informational to say, hey, this is where you are?
Chair, Representative, the dashboard is more informational. Okay. Yeah, that dashboard is more informational. The reports, there are reports, so they will get to know who exactly they have up for renewal in their county.
One more.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it sounds like, I mean, that's one of the new items, but it sort of is a nice, convenient way to track progress, but it's not essential to the work of performing these renewals. Those renewals, that's a nice way to see their progress, but it's not essential to the work of actually completing the renewals. I would be curious, this is not my one question, but I'd be curious to know, you know, some of these aspects are live, like the address update campaign, that's already happening. I'd be curious to know how that's going and what the success of that has been. And then really looking at the governor's proposals, there's the extra time to spend down assets. I assume that there's normally a look back on that so that spend down can't happen that quickly. I'd be curious to know how that works. You talked about the Navigator organizations, how they receive payment based on the number of enrollees. So I'd be curious to know how that has been affected throughout this period of not doing renewals, because presumably they want extra money now, but presumably they're going to have a ton of enrollees now. And perhaps that money was actually needed 2 years ago when they didn't have new enrollees or these renewals. So I'm a little confused about that. And the bottom line is, what I don't see in these proposals
is money going to our counties? Our counties are the ones who are actually doing the work of the renewals. And while I appreciate that the state has committed, I think it was 42,000 of those of the household renewals, I'd be curious to know if in the governor's budget request, and there were several different pieces to it, so it's not entirely clear to me, but in the governor's budget request, does any of this DHS funding trickle down to the counties, since they're the ones who are actually doing the work of the renewals?
Lots of questions there. I don't think we have the time to respond.
The last one is the one I care about the most.
I'm sure we'll do a follow-up on all those aspects. There's a lot that we need to do in the next few weeks. Vice Chair Van.
Thank you.
I will ask, and then we'll get everything wrapped up. I'll give the assistant commissioner to close. Go ahead.
Okay. Just really quickly. So I guess I'm kind of concerned too about the idea of being, and it's been brought up about being heavily reliant on paper and how that translates to the counties to be able to do their work and get through what seems to be a very epic pile of paper. Mm-hmm. And you had mentioned earlier that we were considering doing some online renewals, that there was some sort of work in progress. I don't know if we are doing that in partnership with Minute or with Deloitte. And specifically, my question was around, do we have any timelines for the availability of said tool? And the other was, have we considered as a part of that tool or the process that we are looking at today, if there are a subset of standardized questions that can help us quickly and easily screen folks in or out, for example, that might help folks who are actually doing the work to be more efficient and determine whether there's a way to cut down the workload by answering key questions and then be able to use that to inform our decisions about whether we need to gather more information from a respondent or less, because perhaps we determine that they are not eligible, and so we don't necessarily need a 20-page form or a 40-page form or whatever that might be. And so I'm just kind of curious on those two points.
To Director Gibson, Assistant Commissioner, if you have response to multiple questions, and we'll see if we have more time.
Mr. Chair and representatives, it's a lot of questions, so I'm going to see if I can understand, which is no judgment. I'm just saying it almost appears to me that more detail needs to come forward, perhaps in subsequent conversations, which we certainly can do. In terms of the counties and the trickle down to counties, as you indicated, so I will rely perhaps on some of our other DHS team if there are some other perspectives on what else is in the governor's budget. But at this point, because the state holds the accountability to the federal government of this effort, these are resources in this particular conversation resources around what the state needs to be able to be responsible for this process. So I'll have to either rely on or come back to that conversation of where county dollars are, what the counties themselves are potentially proposing. And then, let's see, as it relates then to online resources, that is so Minute is very much a partner. I probably should have said that earlier. Minute is very much a partner at the table with us day in, day out, and Deloitte too is helping us evaluate this. So time, I don't know if I can give a real concrete view of timeline. I don't know how you feel about that, Karen, but then some of the questions that you've raised or some of the suggestions you've looked at, I think that's something we should take a look at, make sure I'm understanding that enough so I don't respond inappropriately. I'm not a tech expert, and so would not want to overspeak or underspeak, I guess, on that. So we'll capture that and see if we can come back to with a little more detail.
Representative Ryan, then Kwam will end the questions, and we'll talk more about this. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. I'll be very both quick and have a simple question. You know, in terms of the communication and reaching constituents, we are all connected to our constituents in a very direct way. Do you have resources for us to be able to share readily via social, via email, in whatever format that we wish? Because I think that might be a good direct piece of information, but we would like it to be accurate and consistent. Thanks.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Ryer, yes. Thank you very much. We would love that, and we do have readily available information to go out, and we would be happy to connect on that or provide that information, because I agree that sort of push out of that information, certainly on address, get your address up to date, and even further explanation of how this would work would be very, very helpful.
Representative Kwok.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. About 8 to 10 years ago, Representative Hicks and I worked together on proposed language to generate a portal which could be utilized by the counties, a functional portal for counties and for our citizens, because of the strange mishmash of patchwork of different programs. Before having it jacketed, I contacted the IT and department personnel, and 8 people met with me and assured me that they were already working on a portal that would allow for the interaction to gain information and to be able to submit and do, which means it would be functional. You could use it to actually get work done and not have the delays of the mail, which sometimes are several days longer now because they've closed offices. So I'm disappointed that in that 8 to 10 years, where we're not at. When the opening statement, I look at it, if we have fewer people qualifying, do we have people that have been successful? Many people with disabilities, with the new technology and stuff, the joy in their eyes and their hearts when they're able to be independent. That's wonderful. And a few years ago, I tried to have, instead of the cutoff, there would be a waiver so we could do a transitional so that, no, I can't work that extra hour because I'll be over the dollar target. And so, you know, maybe if you made $100 over, you would pay in a portion of that towards covering your benefits, but you kept the benefits and you kept some of the extra pay. So you transition to a point of where you could fully be independent without having the extra help. That would be a great, wonderful thing to have. You talk about qualifying. The technology and aids, there should be an exemption for anything that allows you to function and be more independent. There's a lot of electronic stuff. There's a lot of mechanical things. They aren't cheap. I want to make sure, and if we have to get a exemption from the feds, I want to make sure that we don't count as assets key support things that allow independence and capability to our people, because that's a wonderful thing. And that's what we want. And that's what they want. So if we're more intelligent, we're not going to have people fall out for things that they shouldn't be. But let us take joy that we've assisted people to graduate into independence, because I see it in their faces. That's a wonderful thing. Thank you.
Thank you, President Kwam. I know discussing spend down and also the asset limit is significant in this conversation. The asset limit, as I understand, is $3,000 per individual, which is really a low rate. And so we need to be more focused in making sure that no Minnesotan who's eligible for medical assistance is spent down during this process. So the task ahead is huge, and I think we need to be more prepared and ready to go. Did you have any closing remarks, Assistant Commissioner or Director Gibson?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I don't specifically. I probably talked a lot as it is, but we would look forward to then to come to talking with you further, certainly specifically supporting you in your constituent outreach. But know that we are, I think one of you indicated there could be nothing more important. It is, in fact, the priority of the department in a sea of priorities. But it is, we are heavily engaged on it, heavily focused, and are all driving in that direction to assure appropriate the continuation of eligibility and working collectively and collaboratively, all those component pieces that we covered today, all of it is so critical as we drive forward, and we very much appreciate your support and questions.
Director Gibson, anything else? Mm-mm. Thank you so much to both of you. With no further agenda items, we are now adjourned. Thank you so much.